Okay, everybody, good evening. Welcome to the fifth in our series, The Wise Son, ladies of the S&P Sephardi community. Tonight's subject, as it were, Charlotte Montefiore, has an illustrious surname. Of course, the Montefiore is being very well known, but Charlotte herself is less well known. And this is actually, I would say, an important lecture. It's, you know, the fifth of these lectures, and we're going to start seeing, I think, some of the things that we've spoken about to kind of be borne out through her, and to see some of the other figures we've mentioned kind of come back into play, and really kind of see how what we're looking at aren't kind of these, in a sense, these completely isolated, you know, people, isolated cases, but that actually the combined efforts of these ladies really represents a bit of a movement within the Sephardic community, and show kind of this breadth of writing, this breadth of areas of interest, areas of concern, and really what were important, a crucial moment in the history of Anglo-Jewry in the middle of the 19th century. Which, as we started out the series by saying, was a time not so unlike our own, in that it was really the first time in the history of Anglo-Jewry that the majority of Anglo-Jews were native-born. And that really wouldn't be the case again until you get, you know, really to perhaps the generation before us or so, you know, until you get to the latter part of the 20th century, where, you know, from the time you get to the middle of the 19th century, the influx of immigrants really will change the kind of makeup. And those Jewish immigrants will continue to come in until after the Second World War. And so you don't really have a majority Anglo community until later in the century in terms of being native born. And so a lot of things that they're concerned about or that they're thinking about, well, obviously we're talking, you know, 150, 200 years ago, I would say reverberate or resonate with things that we think about today as well. And I found that that was very much the case with Charlotte Montefiore's writing, as we'll see. So she was an interesting lady. She didn't live actually a very long life, unfortunately. Here we have on the bottom of the sheet over here some of the dates of the ladies that we've been talking about. And Charlotte Montefiore, she was from 1818 until 1854, so she didn't live to a very old age. But what's interesting, what I wanted to kind of point out by putting all of these dates here, is to see that we certainly have some of the kind of the earlier writers, the Abigail Lindo, the Lady Judith Montefiore, but then when you talk about Grace Aguilar, Mary Mendes Belisario, Charlotte Montefiore, right, they're all born in the same years, right? Perhaps they, you know, met at synagogue. You know, they would have been, you know, in the community from a very specific, certain age. Certainly Grace, she spent some of her time away from London in childhood, so maybe she was less known. But presumably, at least Miriam Belisario and Charlotte Montefiore, they were, you know, they were within 2 years of each other. And in certain regards, as we'll see, some of their writings were similar in terms of the kind of the genre of writing, but kind of take a different approach. Which I think is representative of the time period that we're looking at over here. So those are what we're going to kind of be looking at. Now, when thinking about these writings, we had mentioned in previous lectures about what is going on, right? What are the contents? What's prompting these people to write, right? And it's not just for the heck of it, right? Because they're bored, right? They're writing for a specific reason. So we had mentioned previously some of the issues that are going on within the community. Does anybody remember what some of those issues were?
Assimilation.
Right, yeah, assimilation. Right, so just people being less engaged in religion. What else? What other issues?
There was also the conversion.
Yeah, exactly, right, there's missionary activity. We'll see that come up in tonight's lecture. Okay, good. What else?
It was dispersion, wasn't it?
Well, that's for sure, right? And that, I think, plays into this issue of the assimilation that's going on, where people don't have that same kind of framework. We had some other specific things that were going on as well. One of the other ones that's really kind of important, and I would say, is occupying the concerns of men probably more than the ladies, right? Was the question, did everybody think of it?
Emancipation.
Emancipation, yeah. Right, is the fact that Jews can still not take the oath of office at that time, right? And so that's a real concern, right? That they can't participate, right, in the political sphere of England, right? They're still sidelined from the leadership of the country. Another issue that will arise at this time is also reform. Okay? And the fifth that we're gonna start to see to come up today, where we kind of looking at kind of the focus on, you know, this pushback against reform, is, well, kind of flip side of what perhaps the reformers might be lobbying against, right? Which is kind of this, what they might call religious obscurantism, right? The sense that, right, the religion has become a bit stale, right? And that those concerns as well, right? And we'll see that that is not only a concern of, you know, the reformers in a sense with the capital R, but even with the lowercase r, right? That people in the community are aware, are concerned about the fact that is the religion speaking to people anymore? Has it become a bit too ossified in the sense that people are just focusing on the laws, right? And the kind of the deeper meaning of Judaism has been lost. Okay, and so that'll be something they're gonna be thinking about as well. Right, and a lot of the reason that the ladies are thinking about this, and we've seen this in the writings, is that oftentimes at this time, the educators are the women in the community, right? So many of them, we mentioned, had schools, right? Abigail Lindo had a school, Grace Aguilar had a school, Mary Benes Balisario had a school, right? They're the educators within the community, and even the ones who don't run schools themselves are often involved in educational projects, perhaps as the wealthier class within the community, right, and being the sponsors for the different educational initiatives that are kind of developing during this time. And so they're really thinking about these issues and thinking about the question of what's going to be with the next generation, right? And so a lot of these things, right, are occupying their mind, while for the men, their occupation is going to be more about, well, what it had been probably, things like commerce, right, and trade, and the stock market, and things like that, right, and they're kind of focused on those issues, while it seems the women are the ones who are more concerned about, well, you know, while you guys are all just kind of dealing with, you know, your job, putting food on the table, right, what's going to be with the next generation, okay, and so that's something that this really occupies the area of women, and while these will be kind of questions, things will be discussed in other countries as well. In other countries, it seems to be addressed by Jewish men. England is unique in that it's women that are addressing these issues. And so while there will, historians will often kind of look at the lack of kind of scholarship among Anglo-Jewry, and that certainly is the case in regards to men, when it comes to women, they actually have more scholarship than women in other countries, right? And so that's a really kind of interesting thing to point out about what's happened within the Anglo community. Okay, now in looking at these different women, we saw that they engaged in a whole range of different kinds of writing, right? They did different kinds of things. So what kind of writing did they do? What kinds of writings?
Hebrew alphabets.
Yeah, okay, right. So they're doing vocabularies.
Mm-hmm. Religious education, broadly speaking.
What do you mean by that?
Miriam Belisario conversation between us.
Yeah, so we might call that polemic, okay? Right, they're engaging in polemic. What else?
Novel.
Yeah, novel, right, so they're doing novels, okay? Now, when we come to novels, we can talk about different kinds of novels. So remember the different types we've spoken about? So there's a few different types you mentioned, right? You have, right, romantic fiction, right, which are these kind of historic pieces, oh, you know, taking place in the 14th century type of stories. We had another type that we called domestic fiction, right? So these are just stories taking place in people's homes, but they're idealized images of Jewish home life, okay? And then we had another type, which we might call more didactic, right? Where really the story has a very specific educational purpose to it. Now, while all of these may serve some kind of purpose regarding fighting assimilation or missionary activity through the story, right? The didactic ones are really going to be kind of much more clear, you know, apparent what their objectives are. Okay, so that's good. What other kinds of any other kinds of writings?
Cookbook.
Cookbook. Yeah. So we might almost call some of these things, right? Like these manuals.
Yeah.
Right. Right. You might even put the vocabulary together with that. Right. You're kind of these practical types of things. And then something we didn't look at so much ourselves, though we know they were doing it as well, was writing poetry. Right, that's also something that they're engaging in with too. And I'm trying to think of anything else. I think that's it. Okay. Yeah. Oh, and the one thing we didn't mention is that we didn't get into this so much that we know that Grace Aguilar writes it, is they also write history. Some of the first histories that were written during that time as well. Okay, so that gives a sense of kind of this scope, right? This breadth of different things that they're doing, right? And in certain ways, it's mimicking what's happening in broader English society, right? And there's also these kinds of endeavors, these kinds of activities that are going on as well. And so this is where we enter into the question, or kind of the story of Charlotte Montefiore, and where she's going to get involved in a really interesting way in doing something which is new, which is different than what's been happening before, even though it will end up being in some way similar to other things and involve other people that we've already spoken about, okay? And she's going to launch an initiative, okay? The initiative that she's going to launch is called Cheap Jewish Library, okay? And what the Cheap Jewish Library is going to do is going to produce a series of stories that will be sold for pennies or given away to Jewish people. It will not be something which is sold in the stores. It's going to be kind of an in-person type of distribution, and will include stories and things like that definitely have a didactic perspective. It definitely is for practical reasons, and it's going to be targeting specifically the Jewish working class, right? Or what we might even call the lower class.
What's the library they were sitting the books, the materials?
So it's not a library like a lending library, right? Just meant this kind of this. It's a library. It's a collection of writings, essentially. Yeah. So that's a good point, right? So that's who it's going to be targeting. Now, who is Charlotte Montefiore? Why is she getting involved in these things? Well, one thing that's clear, she is not part of the lower class at all, right? She is actually from a really illustrious family line. There was a book that was written about the families of Anglo-Jewry. It's not kind of historic to refer to them. The title of the book is called The Cousinhood. So she is part of the cousinhood. She is from the elite families of Anglo-Jewry. And we'll say that she's actually part of a number of them. Okay, so let's do a little bit of her story, right? So obviously the most famous Montefiore is Sir Moses, right? So you have Moses, okay? Moses will have a brother whose name is Abraham, okay? Abraham is going to marry a Rothschild, okay? Now, it's a different Rothschild. Now, Moses, right, is of course married to Judith, whose sister is going to be married to a Rothschild, right? So Moses will be related to the Rothschilds through his wife's sister's husband, okay? But this Abraham, he's going to marry the Rothschilds, not the English Rothschilds, but into the French Rothschilds, right? Because he has five sons, right? And they kind of go to different places, right? So this is going to be into the French side, right? While this is going to be in the Anglo side, okay? Abraham is going to have a daughter, Charlotte. Okay? So she's doing all right, right? So she's born into that. So that's Charlotte Montefiore, right? She has a very exceptional, opportunities as a child. It seems that she probably privately tutored, educated, perhaps by her mother. And she's incredibly well-read, knowledgeable, but also really passionate, right? She embraces this role that you find among kind of the elite of English society at that time, where they see that they have a purpose or a responsibility for the well-being of others in society, right? And this becomes a great passion of the Victorian age, the betterment of the lower classes, and it's something that really occupies her time, right? To the extent that she's going to launch the first publication, the Chief Jewish Library, is going to be in 1841, right? And again, we mentioned she was born in 1818, okay? So she's still going to be, a young lady. She's only 23 years old at the time, right? As you can imagine, nowadays, like a 23-year-old, like, launching this big thing, you'd be like, who do you think you are? That you're gonna do this initiative and kind of take this leadership role. Like, you know better than everybody else. And, well, maybe she does, right? I mean, she's grown up in that milieu. And so she really is thinking about the Jewish lower class, right? And how she can help the lower class to kind of raise themselves up, right? And to help them kind of pull themselves out of squalor, right? So it's kind of bettering themselves, but also being in touch with kind of the pure ideas of religion, right? That they shouldn't kind of become less engaged in religion and so on, right? So she's really thinking about those issues. And that's going to lead her to launch this initiative, the Chief Jewish Library. Now, Chief Jewish Library is not her only, based on her own efforts, right? And this is where it gets really interesting. It's going to be a combination of her writing and also the writing of Grace Aguilar, okay? So this is a real coup that she's going to pull off. As you mentioned, Grace Aguilar is the most well-known English Jewish authoress. She will be read, her publications will not be only targeting the Jewish community, right? She's written, in certain regards, even for the non-Jewish community, right? So she's a well-known authoress and, is a well-known figure. But her writing activity has been primarily targeting the non-Jewish community, or at the very least, a readership that would involve Jews and non-Jews. As we mentioned, she herself had gone through something. She had originally been writing the historical romances, and then she had switched into domestic fiction. But one of the challenges of writing domestic fiction is, depending who your audience is, it means how much of it you have to explain, right? So if you're writing to a Jewish audience and you're talking about a Jewish home, you don't necessarily have to explain everything that's happening, because people know, what Shabbat is. But if you're writing for a general audience, obviously that changes the way that you have to write out things, and that was something she had to figure out how to do as she moved into writing this domestic fiction. She is pulled onto the project, right? So this is a major coup. They have such a well-known figure that's going to participate, but she's not approached by Charlotte Montefiore. She is approached by Reverend DeSola, okay? Reverend DeSola has been, in a sense, petitioned by Charlotte Montefiore to act as a go-between. Charlotte Montefiore wants to remain anonymous throughout this project. Her name will not appear anywhere in this project. It won't become clear of her involvement until after her death. During her lifetime, nobody knows that she's involved in this project. Her name doesn't appear on any of the books. She asks DeSola to participate in this project. He agrees to do that. But she wants to remain anonymous, and so she says that she wants him to approach Aguilar to ask her to participate, and that essentially to make sure that he never tells her who the other author is. Now, one of the things that's interesting is she then sets up this really interesting kind of way of corresponding between them. Because one of the things that they decide to do is that, yes, De Solo is going to kind of be there, and he can kind of look at the works, and, you know, is there anything in there that's maybe, you know, not in accordance with, you know, the religion? But really, there needs to be editing of their works, right, and kind of this collaboration. And so what will happen is De Solo will swap their books, and they're going to be editing each other's writings. So Aguilar will end up editing Montefiore's writing, not knowing that Montefiore is the author, though Montefiore will be editing Aguilar's writings, knowing that she's editing, you know, Grace Aguilar. So there definitely is a bit of a a disparity between this relationship. And what's interesting is they do come from different classes, right? You're going to have, obviously, Charlotte coming from the upper class. Grace Aguilar is more from the middle class. And so that will definitely be kind of this kind of built-in kind of difference between the writings. But obviously, Grace is so well known, right, that that's something which is respected.
Now, I had a quote over here I wanted to share from this.
She writes the following about what she wanted the library to contain, right? So she says that it consisted of moral and religious tales or useful information, right? So again, these kind of things that she has, not just writing an interesting book, but something that really you're putting out of, that you're writing it in order to convey a particular message. She wrote that amongst the many means that have been employed to inculcate religious truths and principles of morality, none have proved more efficient than the publication of tracts in the form of tales conveying instruction and entertainment, right? And so they're taking a calculated approach to say that if you want to teach people, you can't just write, you know, a book of halakha. You can't just take a book of law, a polemical writing, you know, the Miriam Mendes Belisario type of track where you just kind of find, these are the 13 principles, you know, this is how we understand them, but rather you write a story, right? And through stories, people will pull out of it the values and the messages. And right, this is something which is definitely very common within, right, Victorian literature, right, that it's, right, this moralist kind of writing, and it's something that they're taking and they're saying, that's a great idea, we're going to do that as well, we're going to write tales that convey particular, have particular messages. What will be interesting, and this is what kind of some historians are writing about, this kind of, these different classes that you're finding over here, is that you're going to find, all of a sudden, Grace Aguilar, who previously has been writing books for essentially her own class. She's a writer, other middle class people are reading her works, but for the first time, Grace Aguilar is in a sense going to be writing as an elite, right? For all of a sudden, she's writing for the lower class, right? And so she's kind of going through this transition where all of a sudden, she's acting like a lady, right? She's acting kind of in the elite part of society in that regard. And the thing that it allows her to do, now that she's writing for a purely Jewish audience, right, is that it allows her to write in a different kind of way, right? Because she no longer has to explain what she's writing, and because the distribution of all of this is going to be, you know, kind of these one-to-one, these personal distributions, it means that this is not something that is necessarily going to just be part of, picked up in her general writing. It's something she can really write with the confidence that this is going to be going to the Jewish community. And that obviously will change the kind of writing she can do. And it shows the transition that she's having in her own writing, where, you know, she's starting out by writing these historical, you know, romances and, you know, kind of writing for the general public, trying to, you know, make sure that Jews have a more favorable view among general society. But as she kind of moves through her writing career, she's becoming more concerned about writing things that will impact not just the standing of the Jewish community, but will actually impact the Jewish community itself, right, in the way that they conduct themselves, okay? And so she's going to write a work, this is one of the writings of Grace Aguilar, in this called The Perez Family, okay? It's not surprising, right, that a lot of her characters are Sephardic, right? So it's The Perez Family. So I'm just gonna read to you a description of the book, and you'll get a sense, again, of the kind of writing that she's doing now, which is gonna be different than what she's previously written. Kyle, you haven't read this one yet.
No, I haven't read that one.
Mother Box. Okay, so let's see what it says over here. It says, to realize this aim, she tells the story of a working-class Jewish family in Liverpool, whose mater familias must undergo the trials of Job and withstand them. Right, Job being this biblical character who suffers. In this case, Job is a petite bourgeois woman named Rachel Paris, whose faith in God is tested when her house burns down. She loses the use of an arm in rescuing her daughter from the flames. Her beloved husband dies and leaves them penniless. Her profligate eldest son marries a Christian woman, and her devoted niece is forced to leave her to care for her dying father. So her whole life has fallen apart. Like Job, Rachel attempts to remain upright and pure in the face of adversity. She does this in a particularly Aguilarian way, as a mother instructor. She gathers her family around every Sabbath Eve to give them a discourse on a particular verse in the Torah, the most relevant one being, commit the ways to the Lord, commit thy ways to the Lord, and also trust in him, and he will bring it to pass. Providing the truth of this verse, that mitzvot and faith will bring rewards, is the burden of the story. And indeed, Rachel's mitzvot and faith are ultimately rewarded. Her daughter, blinded by the fire, regains her sight. Her wayward eldest son returns to the fold and marries her returned loving niece. Her youngest son chooses to become a chazan, and she herself is filled with joy. So what better thing than have a son become a chazan? And so... Right, cousin, exactly. So summary of it is taken from this book by Michael Bilshinsky, The Origin of the Modern Jewish Woman Writer. So if you're kind of interested in this the genre, he goes into this in reform and romance, romance and reform in Victorian England. You can see in that story, right, where it's really kind of this very moralist story that she's written, which is a departure from the other kinds of things that she's put together. Charlotte will write also a number of tracts for this. She'll write one called Kalva Asher, which is actually an anti-missionary tract, which is essentially a satire of missionaries and trying to show, you know, their despicable behavior, trying to get, you know, poor Jews who have nothing to eat, you know, and how they're kind of using these different methods to kind of get Jews to convert and so on. And so, you know, there's this whole part of the of what's going on over here where you kind of see this real kind of focus on these practical issues, you know, that are going on, people having faith, being committed to their religion, against conversion, family values, Jewish family values, and so on, right, that they're trying to inculcate for the working class, right? They're sold for pennies, right? It's meant to be for that particular group. It's obviously difficult to know what impact these writings have, because by definition, they're writing for a group of people that aren't doing the writing, so we don't necessarily know about it. All we know are maybe reviews that have appeared in, you know, the Jewish Chronicle or, you know, something of the time that would give us at least some sense of the way that some of these writings are being received. Now, they were published in serial form, okay, so they would have kind of been broken down. The publication goes from 1841 until 1848, okay? So it lasts a good number of years. And I think it includes something like 10 different books, essentially, that are serialized in them. And so that's kind of an important endeavor that she engages on. Now, she's then going to work on something else, and that's what I have taken up over here. And this she's going to come out with a number of years later. Right? This is the A Few Words to the Jews by One of Themselves. Right, so from the things we've been talking about over here, what kind of stands out about this?
The layout is
anonymous. Right, so it's anonymous. Okay, so that's not entirely, unique. Anything else that's maybe different from some of the other ones that we've seen?
I like the layout because your eyes are drawn to the Jews, and then you notice the rest.
Yeah. So this kind of structure, that's kind of similar. I mean, they all kind of have this very kind of simple type of, you know, just the words themselves. Anything else that maybe is different than some of the other kind of title pages?
Well, you have no idea whether it's a man or a woman.
Exactly. You don't know if it's a man or a woman, which is really interesting. And one of the things that you also then don't have on there is there's no kind of name of an editor or something like that, right? So many of the other writings would have said, you know, edited by David Meldola, Sabato Marais, De Sola, right? She doesn't do that, right? This is purely anathema. Is that because she's part of the upper class and really just doesn't feel that she needs to do that? It's interesting. What's interesting is that even in the Cheap Jewish Library, De Sola's name doesn't appear. And it seems part of that is he doesn't want to get the credit for it. Because his name does appear in other things, but he doesn't want it to appear in there because it's not saying who the authors are. Well, Grace Aguilar's name will appear on hers, but the ones from Charlotte won't appear. So he doesn't want to, in a sense, be credited with the project, so his name doesn't appear on that.
Or Blake.
But you would almost expect his name would have appeared on something like this. And I think we'll see why maybe it doesn't. It could just be she just chose to not have it anyway, but it could be that there's a reason that it doesn't appear. This one, as opposed to Miriam Mendes Belsar, where she was writing kind of about Judaism, right? And it's kind of, she writes as this conversation, it's kind of exploring, you know, Jewish beliefs and things like that. This book is really a pure polemic, right? She is writing to the Jewish people, this is what I think, okay? And what's interesting is the fact that it is anonymous. It's just this thing that's been written, that's circulated, and it's meant to kind of be, people are going to pick it up and be like, did you read that thing? Oh my gosh, what do you think about it in that way? And then it's not going to be associated with, oh, that's, you know, Charlotte Montefiore doing her thing, right? You don't know where this comes from. Again, she obviously has the means to publish, to self-publish these kinds of works, and she's going to communicate the things that are important to her. She's going to publish it in 1851, okay? And I think that's going to be an important date, as we shall see. Now, I should mention that in 1847, she marries, okay? She marries in 1847. Who does she marry? She marries a fellow by the name of Horatio Montefiore. Who's Horatio Montefiore? Their younger brother, right? So younger brother of Moses and Abraham, right? And so she will end up marrying her uncle, okay? She will end up marrying her uncle, whose first wife has deceased, okay? So she's going to marry him. Now, one of the things that's interesting about things that we've seen is that most of the ladies that we've spoken about have a similarity in that they were not married, okay, or didn't have children, right? And so she very much fits that. I mean, she basically, the publication ends after she's married, right? She gets married in 1847, and so that's kind of interesting, right? Again, that idea is, you know, if you're single or if you don't have children, maybe you have the freedom to engage in these kinds of things, but you know, once you're married with kids, you know, you have that responsibility and you don't do these kinds of things. So what's interesting is that these writings are really being done not by maybe women in general, but you know, the spinsters or, you know, kind of that type of that part of the community that has the freedom to engage in those activities, right? Even Lady Judith, who writes, she doesn't have children, right? And so that's kind of an interesting part of this group of women as well. It's not just kind of, you know, women in general, it's very certain kinds of women, you know, that are doing that writing. Okay, so we'll take a look at that because this is going to be important in the story as well. So what I'd like to do is to actually look through some of the pieces in the writing. I went through the first few essays. It's a collection of 12 essays. I think it's 12 or 10 essays. We'll take a look at some of the things that she writes about in here. I figured what better way to talk about it is to actually just see a little bit about what she writes. So let's take a look at this over here. So here she writes about commitment to Judaism. And she writes the following. This is at the beginning. And here she's talking about the challenge that you find, that there are many Jews that are not involved in certain kinds of professions, right? And the sense that perhaps, you know, the typical Brit is looking at this and being like, you know, oh, these Jews, they all live, you know, in East London, and they're all involved in you know, the same, you know, they're stockbrokers or they're merchants, you know, and they're not involved in all these other kinds of things that are so British that you would expect. And so she's kind of responding to that, you know, in a sense, you know, why is that the case? Is it because Jews don't aspire to these other kinds of things, to being farmers or to serving in the Navy and so on? She goes, no, it's not true that we don't aspire, but there's reasons that this is the case. So let's read what she says. She goes, he has, for who has not, who owns a country and a home, patriotism, right? So he has patriotism, enthusiasm, and ambition, but these are fettered, or at least must find another scope for their gratification than in the careers that usually afford both the incentive and the reward. He may aspire after military and naval fame. He may delight in an adventurous career, or he may long for an agricultural life, for the country's bright skies and vernal voice and peaceful scenes. But the longing and the desire are subdued for, to cherish or to yield to either is to renounce a prouder ambition and a pure satisfaction. What is that? That of remaining true to the faith of Sinai and sharing the destiny and enjoying the fellowship of those who hold a kindred name, a kindred worship, and a kindred hope. Right? And so what she bears over here, and she then goes into detail and talks about, you know, why Jews aren't in the military, you know, at that time. Why aren't Jews going and settling in India? Why aren't Jews, you know, taking up farms? And she talks about the practical, you know, problems, you know, that in these naval vessels, you know, they celebrate the Sabbath on Sunday. And if a Jew's there, they can't participate in that worship. And on the day that they need to rest, they won't be able to. And if you're out in the farms, then you don't have Jewish community. And how does that work? You need other Jews around to kind of live a full Jewish life. And, you know, go to India and you're completely isolated. And she kind of goes through it and says, there's practical reasons, but it's not because the Jewish heart doesn't aspire to these things, because the Jew is less, you know, honorable or, you know, or less of a patriot than anybody else. But for certain kind of religious reasons, Jews are limited. They're practically limited to do that. And what you get from here is that she's saying that's a real, you know, concern that Jews have, and it's reasonable why Jews aren't going to engage in these, in all of these different kind of endeavors. And she accepts that, and she certainly advocates, and she's that's a good choice that these Jews are making. But you do get the sense that in her, these tracts, in a sense, that she is pained by that. Like, she is bothered by the fact that, in a sense, by being Jewish, we are limited in the engagement we can have within the world. Because she feels that in our essence, and this thing she's going to really talk about, in its essence, Judaism does aspire to be fully a part of the world. And that is who we are, you know, in principle or in theory. It just, in certain times in practice, that becomes challenge. And that's always kind of a challenge of how do you balance those two things, where you want to remain true to, you know, as she says, to Sinai. But at the same time, in our essence, we are people of the world as well. And we also want to kind of participate in what happens. And kind of, there's acceptance, kind of this reluctant acceptance. She says, well, sometimes it's just not possible. Sometimes it's just not possible. But that shouldn't make people think that Jews are any less part of it because they aren't participating. It's simply because there are certain limitations on our ability to do so. So that's really interesting. And you kind of start really see her kind of worldview within this. She then goes on tirades. I mean, a lot of this is a tirade against things. So she talks about what she considers to be insincere Judaism. So let's just read a couple of things where she talks about insincere Judaism. She writes the following. She says, the ambition of some individuals is to be looked up to as saints, is to play a conspicuous part in the religious world. And so the outward garb of sanctity is assumed, the public forms and rites of their creed are strictly performed, whilst the mind and heart are left in ignorance of its spirit, and the world perhaps applauds while God is mocked by hypocritical worship. And so here she really kind of goes on the attack of what she sees is this kind of outward piety that is not reflective of inward piety, and that ultimately, right, she says this is, you know, hypocrisy, and she's not saying that the outward piety is bad. She's not advocating against that. She's saying the problem is that if it's not reflective of an inward piety, then that's essentially just what she calls it, materialism, right? That's just a focus on the outward, on the physical. And that is, you know, like the worst kind of thing that you could do, to just be focused on the physical. And in her writing, she, I mean, what's interesting, she is from this high class, but she goes on tirades against the pursuit of wealth and kind of that's, you know, this main focus. And she kind of talks about how that happened. You know, she said where, you know, in order for Jews to get the things that they should have gotten just for the fact that we're humans, we essentially had to have money to kind of curry favor. And she said, even though now we live in a time where we don't have to pay to get that kind of favor, she goes, it's become ingrained in us to just pursue wealth, because there was a time when we had to have wealth in order to just have basic rights. But she says, but that's a problem in the sense we've just now kind of pursuing these things for their own sake, when ultimately the objective of life shouldn't be wealth, but should be kind of one's inner development. And so she really is bothered deeply by what she calls this materialism of religion, these outward activities. And what's interesting here, and this is the kind of thing I think we'll kind of see some comparison with Grace, is she writes the following in page 53. She goes, we led therefore almost simultaneously two lives, one false, one real, but they necessarily mingled the impure, sullying the pure, the fictitious, degrading the true. Okay? So what does she mean over here that we lived two lives? So she's probably referring to when we were Maranos, right, to the conversos, right, who were living these two lives, right, outwardly living as Christians, inwardly as Jews, right, we needed to do so for survival. But she doesn't look at, I mean, on one level, obviously it's heroic that we maintained it, but she looks at it that by definition, it ended up sullying it, right, that they necessarily mingled the impure sullying the pure, the fictitious degrading the true, right? She said it wasn't like, you know, 200 years into living as conversos, we were living this pure Judaism anymore. Obviously, it degraded over time, right? And we know that that is true. And she says, don't look back at this as like this, you know, glorious time. She goes, it's not, meaning you can't live a double life in that regard, you know, one way on the outside, another way on the inside. By definition, it will ultimately sully what you have over there. And what's interesting is this may be kind of a difference of opinion between her and Aguilar. Because when we had spoken about Grace, we saw that one of the things that she advocated was specifically that. She said, you know, you should be a Jew in the home, but in the street, you shouldn't be doing your kind of distinctive Jewish practices in public. Right? Those are meant for privacy at home, but in public, we should be acting in a way where kind of all the people can be one, right, can be the same. And it could be, she's partly kind of opposed to that, where she feels that, you know, trying to kind of bifurcate in that way ultimately means that you're going to negatively impact the Jewish part as well. And so that may be kind of an interesting kind of take. And we find that Grace Aguilar, and certainly in some of her writings, also really celebrates this kind of converso history and, you know, and the heroics of it and how, you know, amazing and remarkable it was. And, well, again, I imagine, you know, Charlotte would recognize, you know, that, you know, in light of the options, maybe that was heroic, but ultimately we shouldn't be idealized, right? That's not the ideal way to be. So what's interesting is they're, you know, they're both Sephardic, they're both kind of commenting on this part of this Sephardic history, but they're kind of each taking different things from it. You know, Grace is kind of looking at it almost as a paradigm, and Charlotte is looking at it as, you know, a bidiyavad, you know, something that was, you know, we did to survive, but shouldn't be the model for what we do going forward.
She's half Rothschild.
Yes.
And the Rothschild background never had that concept of having to hide yourself.
Right, so maybe she's kind of had that influence.
So she would be conflicted in her views. And maybe one stronger than the other. I mean, she's seen part of her background.
Yeah.
Her antecedents.
Yes.
Didn't have to do that.
Yes.
And survive.
Yeah.
Had all sorts of other problems, right, but not that particular one. So she's got a bit of experience of both sides.
Yeah.
So she's telling it as it is,
Right, maybe.
With a slightly mixed background, as opposed to one that knows only
that way of serving. Yes. Yeah, it's really interesting. It's always a trick with these things, you know, how much to kind of read in their story into their writing. We don't know, right? Obviously, it's hard to know for sure. But that's definitely a possibility. Yeah, did you want to say something?
No, I was going to say that.
Okay. You do want to say something. Yeah.
Because the other half of the Montefiore, the Montefiore works for Livorno, and it's a slightly different story, because they were actually invited there, and almost it was a privilege to be that type of Jew, because Spanish Jews had privileges to the extent that most Jews were calling themselves Spanish, even if they were Portuguese, Italian, or whatever, to get the privilege. So she's completely away from
the ancestry still would have been that as well.
But there is a different element from the Maranos that ended up hidden. In Livorno, they were not hidden.
Well, no, they had left. But maybe prior to arriving there, they would have been. The same way that the Jews in England also obviously weren't hiding anymore either.
Not necessarily.
But prior, you know.
Because a lot of Jews in Livorno arrived from Istanbul, where they were not hidden.
I don't think the Montefiore family was. I don't think that's the Montefiore line, but maybe. I mean, the community in Livorno at that time that they would have come from was predominantly Portuguese. It was a Portuguese community.
Yes, but from Istanbul.
So, yeah. Okay, let's go on over here and see that. I'd be curious to see more about that if you have anything on it.
If you have
anything more writing on it, let me know.
Geographically, I'll look at.
Because I think while that's true of Venice, that's not true of Livorno. I think Livorno is really Portuguese Moranos that go there.
But you'll
let me know.
I'll look at Italian sources.
Okay. So let's go on. Let's just look at one more thing over here. We're going to look at kind of what does she see as sincere Judaism, right? So we saw what insincere Judaism. What is sincere Judaism? So she writes the following. She goes, "It is not enough to be a Jew because our father was a Jew before us. But Judaism, to be anything, must be a truth to the individual, a living, glorious truth, to whose fulfillment he can conscientiously devote his life. We each must read the Bible for ourselves, and for ourselves recognize its revelation and accept its precepts. Our brother's faith, however, great and true, cannot carry one but himself to heaven." Right? And so he says, you can't look around and say, well, you know, that person is religious. You know, or I'll just kind of go with the flow, right? Everyone has to have their own personal relationship with their tradition, right? And she's advocating you should actually read the Bible yourself, right? Don't just listen to other people's readings of the Bible or other people's interpretations, right? You should go back to the source yourself to study it, right? And that's an interesting kind of focus on reading of the Torah, right? That's something which certainly resonates as kind of something very Sephardic, right? Kind of the focus on the reading of Torah, not just, you know, studying the Talmud and so on, but actually kind of that everyone should study Torah themselves, could be, maybe. But there really is this idea that each person has to have their own kind of personal piety, their own personal religious fervor. You can't just go with the flow. You can't just say, well, you know, I'm part of a community and the community itself. No, it's individual, right? She's really focused on the notion of the individual in this regard.
It's an individual's relationship with religion rather than religion by rote.
Yes, very much. It's something that's really...
Which is very much the English thing as opposed to the Jewish thing in the Victorian.
The Victorian time would have been what?
You accepted the religious teaching.
As it is.
As was, you criticized it. You carried on with it. Everybody else carried on with it. Because somebody said so. That's why you have preachers.
Right.
But that, superficially, probably deeply, is saying, this isn't, rote isn't your religion.
Yes, exactly.
Your religion is you.
Yeah.
And what you think of it. So, but that could be a wider range of things, because individuals think differently.
So that's an interesting thing, and that's where I kind of mentioned that the years are important. Horatio is famous because he joins the new West London synagogue, right? So he's part of the group that founds the Reform synagogue in West London. Now she's writing this in 1851 after her marriage.
So that's the brother that he falls out.
Well, exactly. So prior to her marriage, she's probably within Bevis Marks, as far as we can tell. She's working with De Sola. Is it by 1851, you know, you would have expected someone like De Sola to be on a work like this. Maybe De Sola wouldn't put his name on something like this at that. I don't know. You know, I wonder. So far what I've read, I haven't seen anything where she is writing, you know, against, you know, in that sense, but she's definitely making some disparaging remarks. She has a kind of comment here about, you know, the rabbis, and so she definitely is, you see some of those elements. Are those elements that she's picked up through now her marriage and being at that synagogue, that she's kind of like embraced that? I don't know. I think that requires a little bit more analysis to say for sure, but it is interesting kind of the dates. And as you mentioned, there's a real falling out between Moses and Horatio, that after Horatio joins that synagogue or helps with that synagogue, he's cut off from Sir Moses. And even on his deathbed, he writes Sir Moses that he's dying. And Sir Moses says, I'll come visit you if you, you know, now, you know, renege on your kind of, and you, in a sense, return to Bevis Marks, which he doesn't do. And Sir Moses doesn't go to visit him before he dies. And so, you know, you wonder kind of the tension there that Sir Moses was very close with his brother Abraham, right? They went into business together. Abraham seemed to have been difficult. He really kind of advocated for him. You know, that's perhaps how he ended up marrying a Rothschild. And, you know, this is his niece. You wonder kind of how this all kind of played out with kind of the emotion, especially now if the niece is kind of married into this new West London synagogue and she's advocating for, it's unclear, you know, at least from what I've read so far, it's unclear like how much he's advocating for reform of like new West London reform, or just the kind of reforms that you're finding even in Bevis itself, which is greater piety, greater education, you know, things of that nature. She's clearly deeply religious, right? She's not one of these people that are part of, you know, this reform movement that are really using it as a pretext of their kind of negative attitudes against Jewish tradition, broadly speaking. She is deeply committed to Jewish tradition. You can see throughout her writings. In fact, the next part over here is my favorite part in the entire book. Let's see if I can scroll over here. She writes the following, page 36. She goes, "At present, no English gentleman of any standing educates his child to the pastor's office. Either foreigners are selected to be our rabbis, or they are chosen from amongst our poorer class and receive at the hands of charity, but an inferior education." Right, and something that she's noticing, and this is again, historians notice this very clearly, is that none of the ministers of the community are ever selected from native-born people. In fact, in the entire history of the call, there has never been a chacham who was actually born in England in the over 300-year history of the community. You know, that's really significant, right? And it means that kind of the upper class, right? They're the wealthy. They're focusing, you know, on their trade and the merchants and things of that sort. The only people that maybe kind of go in that direction are the poorer ones, who kind of, you know, they learn how to lead the services and then they can kind of go and act as officiants, right? But in terms of kind of the, you know, scholarly religious leaders, that's not being produced in the community, right? And she sees that not just as an accident, but again, I think she's seeing this as a reflection of kind of the general attitude towards religion and this kind of empty or hollow religion that she's finding, that she's at least, she thinks, she sees in the community, that would make it that, you know, this wouldn't be something that anybody then would therefore be aspiring to, because no one has deep religious fervor that they would want to play that kind of role within the community. And so she sees that there's a real kind of problem in the community. It's why she writes these series of essays to kind of do that. I mean, she talks about at great length, you know, she has this one about, you know, Sabbath observance, where she says, you know, people, you know, just go to shows on the Sabbath, you know, maybe they walk there, you know, they're not breaking Shabbat, but they're doing all these things, you know, they're not actually celebrating Shabbat. They're just kind of using Shabbat as a day to do all these other things that have nothing to really do with Shabbat. And she sees that as, you know, as problematic, because it means that people aren't engaging with Shabbat itself, right, and kind of the religious experience of that day, and but he's using it as a day to do other things. And so she's a deeply religious person, but perhaps a bit more her kind of frustration with the community is perhaps playing itself out in maybe kind of now being part of this Reform community, which she's seeing it as that the Reform movement isn't a movement away from Judaism, but the Reform is a way to, you know, reinvigorate the Judaism, right? From what she sees as kind of this hollow focus on the externals, on the technicalities of the law, to the detriment of the kind of the inner spirit of the law. So it's a really interesting kind of place where she finds herself in, and these different allegiances and so on that's playing a role. I think what I'm going to be doing, and we'll wrap up here for the next series, we have, I'll talk about next class in a second, but the next series we're going to do, I think, in the springtime is going to be entitled The Breakaways. And we're going to look at the breakaway synagogues that are established all around the same time in London, in New York, and in Charleston, that really kind of give perhaps some of the context for the things that we've been looking at about episodes there. I mean, through the communities and to complete havoc for a decade. I mean, it really was the thing going on in the community during the 1840s. So we'll take a look at that, hopefully after Pesach, we'll go into that. But we're gonna do in our next lecture, we're gonna jump across the Atlantic and we're gonna look at the Spanish and Portuguese communities there. We'll look at the women there that are doing writing as well. In fact, they're corresponding with some of the women that we've been studying about. We'll look about some of the ministers there that are involved, like De Sola, but kind of on the American side, and see that really the things we're looking at aren't only local to London, but they're really part of this kind of English-speaking Sephardic world in the 19th century. We'll take a look at some of the important figures from there as well, and see that, you know, they can't all be looked at in isolation. They're actually part of a broader network that are aware of what each other are doing and are actually kind of collectively putting out this literature at that time. So that lecture, I believe, is the first Monday in March.
Line of that describes absolutely perfectly what an English gentleman's family would have done, because the first son would have inherited the estate. The second son would have probably gone into the army. A third son might have gone to India. And the very bottom of the thing, he's only fit to go into the church.
Mm.
And the father might have bought him a parish.
Interesting.
And that's exactly it. No educated.
Right, it's not going to be.
She died at the age of 36.
Yeah, she's young.
Yeah, what did she die from?
I'm not sure if it was childbirth or not. I need to look into where there was. There's not so much written about her, so it requires a little bit more digging around to figure that. It may have been childbirth.
Just childbirth.
Maybe, but I'm not sure. I need to look into it a bit more.
It's very hazardous childbirth.
Yeah, well, in general, a lot of people died then. Yeah. Okay, everyone. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Really good.
Thank you so much.
Really good.